My name is Tom Myrick. I'm the Communications Director for the International Wolf Center, and I'm here today speaking with Jess Edberg, who is our Information Services Director. The reason we're talking with Jess today is because the International Wolf Center has invented an award, the SCAT Award, which is designed to honor the worst depiction or portrayal of wolves and wolf behavior in the media. And we have honored The Gray, the movie The Gray, already this year in 2012. And to our surprise, a book just came out by very famed author Jodi Picoult. Her book is titled Lone Wolf, and we have pulled some excerpts of it out to talk about what's really the case here when it comes to wolf behavior, as opposed to what is being portrayed in this book, which I would be very comfortable in saying it has almost nothing to do with reality and wolf behavior. Can you comment on that, Jess?
Yes. You know, as I was reviewing the book, one of the things I noticed is there's a lot of anthropomorphism, which is where you apply human emotions and human behaviors to an animal. And so although some of the information is based on some theories about wolf behavior, a lot of the information provided is more of a interpretation based on human emotion, rather than looking at the wolf objectively as a wild animal and trying to determine why they might be doing something because of a survival instinct. So what's a little unsettling for me is that although this is a marketed as a fiction book, this writer has a reputation for doing some research for her stories and making sure that she's as realistic as possible to make it a little bit maybe more engaging and intriguing. And so her reputation for that makes me uncomfortable in that people might take her book and assume that this research she's done is actually accurate, and it is not. This writer has a huge following of people that are loyal to her and want to read her books just because they really enjoy her writing style. And so even though, like I said, it is based in fiction, people might go into this book thinking that it's mostly based on fact. And so it makes our job harder because then we are working against not only the misinformation, but also the cultural idea that this writer has credibility.
And we have this perception now that's out there, and I've seen it in blog posts and on Facebook, that people writing comments such as, "Well, I had no idea that wolves, you know, would actually come and feed a human part of a deer carcass." I mean, let's start with that one. I mean, because that's right out of the book. And in our SCAT Award press release, we kind of labeled this, "Honey, I'm home, I brought takeout," which I think is a great way of, setting it up as ridiculous as it is. Here is an excerpt. "From then on, every time the pack went hunting, they brought me food back. Sometimes it was rolled in droppings or urinated upon." Can you comment on the likelihood of that happening?
Yeah. You know, and one of the things that wolves do is they have these very expansive territories. And the territories might range from 2 square miles per animal to 10 or 20 square miles per animal, depending on what food is available and how densely populated that food is. And the only time a wolf pack tends to hunker down in one area is during the pup season. So when the female that's going to give birth dens, she chooses a specific location. She's tied to that location because those pups are extremely vulnerable. They can't, you know, fend for themselves at that time. And so the pack does go out and come back to that central location. However, after about, 4 to 8 weeks, those pups are up, they're moving, they've moved to an above ground area. Very quickly after, within a month or two, the pups are traveling with the pack for short distances. And so after those pups have reached a physical development stage where they can handle travel long distances with the adult, the wolves don't have a site where they leave and come back to, like a year-round den. And so the idea that Luke stayed back and the wolves went out hunting and then brought back food is inaccurate. wolves, once they're out traveling, they are traveling around the entire territory. And say, for example, here in Minnesota, an average territory might be 50 to 70 square miles for a pack of five animals. And so that's a lot of ground to cover. They can easily travel 40 miles in a day. And so the reality would be that Luke would have to travel somewhat to meet back up with those animals. They would not be inclined to kill a deer, consume them for themselves, bring it back to Luke, and then go out hunting in another location again. It doesn't make sense.
They have a kill site. They eat at the kill site and move.
Yeah, they might hang out at that kill site for several days, consuming as much as they can in the time that they have before they're either finished or disturbed from that kill site. And as far as spicing the food with scatter urine, generally we see that if they're marking it. You know, they're possessing that food. Possession behavior it's an instinctual behavior for survival. They're, you know, keeping that food, marking it for themselves. But to do it for flavor or maybe a practical joke to this person because they're unable to travel with the pack is out of the realm of wolf biology.
Mm-hmm. But in the book, and this is an excerpt, and I don't have the page number, but this is an excerpt out of the book. I've been asked repeatedly why a pack of wild wolves would accept a human into their ranks. Why bother with a creature that follows too slowly, stumbles in the dark, can't speak their language fluently, and inadvertently disrespects their leaders? The only answer I can come up with is that they realized they needed to study a human as much as I needed to study them. I'm sorry.
You know, that right there was one of the first things I just had to sit back and laugh, because wolf behavior is ultimately based on instincts. Those genetic urges that give the wolf ammo for survival. Those survival mechanisms are required for them to thrive in the wild in an environment where they're hunting live prey. They can be kicked and killed at any time. They need to defend territory. And so to apply this notion that wolves need to study humans because humans are encroaching on their habitat is a little disturbing. It's that blatant anthropomorphism. You know, wolves don't study, they don't do research like we do. Now, they might adapt to their environment, they might change their method of hunting, or they might change their movement patterns based on environmental influences, but they're not, you know, studying and taking notes and making, you know, mental choices about these things.
And later in the book, this idea is even extended further into wolves teaching a human how to behave in their pack, which is, we'll get to that in a minute, but that's beyond ludicrous, as is the notion that a human could actually live with a wolf pack. And that's kind of the basis of the sections in the book that deal with the character Luke. He is this guy who lives with wolves for several years. That's legend, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, there's all of those cultural mythologies that we've grown up with about children being raised by wild animals, specifically wolves. And the reality is none of those cases have been 100% confirmed. It's all either hearsay, or there's no evidence, or the person involved has passed away. Science tells us that it is physically impossible for that to occur, primarily because of the physical and social development of human beings and the needs that humans have for survival, shelter, food, you know, health services. And so the idea that this individual was able to survive in a true wilderness situation, only consuming what the wolves brought to him, is not based in science.
Seems far-fetched.
To say the least, yeah.
But it's very romantic, and it seems to me that the slant that this book takes is basically the romance of nature and man.
Mm-hmm. And it's not the first time that it's been done. You know, this is, as a fictional book, it is It's very charismatic. It's intriguing. It takes you in the characters. You know, you want to learn more about them and find out more about them, but that's what it is. It's a fictional book. And so, the concern again is people forgetting that it's fiction and taking the wolf information and assuming that it's based in reality.
The author goes on and makes it even more ridiculous with this bit. I would come to learn that an alpha female can read every single bit of food you put into your body, make a choice that's going to keep you strong and fit the pack. And when six wolves are feeding on a single carcass, the alpha will go to the internal organs and the beta will get the muscle-packed rump and the thigh movement meat, and the omega gets the intestinal contents and non-movement meat, like the neck, spine, and rib cage, and the tester wolf, whoever he is, I added that in, will get about 75% non-movement meat and 25% vegetable matter. This breakdown, this mathematical, this precision of dietary delivery, it's amazing. Any truth to this?
No. In one word. There's been a lot of studies done both in captivity and in the wild about the feeding behavior of wolves. And one of the current well-known wolf biologist, Dr. Dave Meach, does say there's some kind of structure to the way that wolves might consume. But it's not I'm going to divvy this out. You get this, you get this, you get this. It's much more complex. You know, it does take into account the dominance. So the social hierarchy within the pack, who made the kill, what wolves are present, which ones are still out traveling around, do they feel threatened? So are they in an area where maybe there's a lot of human activity or maybe they're close to another wolf pack? You know, those things are going to determine how much and how long they stay on that kill site. And generally speaking, according to Dr. Meach, wolves will consume quite a few pounds of food at the areas where they've already gotten into the hide. So the locations of attack, which generally are the neck area or the hind end area. But then they do kind of migrate over into the internal organs because they are a great source of nutrition, lots of vitamins, lots of minerals, lots of energy, but they don't divvy it up. And one of the other parts about this is wolves tend to not consume these stomach or intestinal contents. The prey that they eat are herbivores, they're plant eaters. Wolves require a high protein diet for basic life function. And so consuming those items would not provide a dietary need. They might consume it if they're starving and that's the only thing available. But wolves generally will leave behind those stomach contents. And in the wintertime, if you're out walking around and you find a kill site, you'll often find this bowling ball shaped of rumen content that has frozen and it's just brown, partially digested vegetable matter.
The alpha female can't actually read every single bite of food that you put into your body.
No, I'm going to say no. Nor is there evidence that other wolves can determine based simply on the adrenaline present in urine and scat from the animal that was consumed, whether or not you're a strong pack. There's really no scientific evidence to support that.
Another section of the book I call I Can Hear Your Heartbeat. The author talks about the incredible prowess of wolves to determine all kinds of things about prey from very little trace evidence. She writes, she can sniff at the tufts of grass the moose is fed upon and know from the scent of its teeth how old the animal is. The scent of its teeth. Care to comment on that?
Sure. Yes, that is a load of hogwash or a load of scat, if you'd like to use that term. You know, there are some indicators by scent that wolves can pick up on their prey. Infection, even inflammation, if there's a lot of a different kind of scent that is accumulating in an area. Moose have, oftentimes moose will have tooth decay because of the food that they eat. They get particles lodged in their gum tissue and they get abscess teeth or, receding gums, and so that can produce an infectious smell that wolves might be able to pick up on. But to determine the age of an animal based on smell is not one of those qualities that wolves possess.
She also goes on to write about how the alpha, always going back to the alpha wolf, directing other wolves to do things, in this case, two of them to run next to the shoulder of a moose so they can listen to the heartbeat. So then in turn, they could determine how much terrorizing they should do to this moose to, I guess, hasten its death, or it's hard to say where that went in the book. But
yeah, you know, there's the possibility that wolves might be able to hear the heartbeat if they are close enough to the animal, if there's not a lot of other, you know, ambient noise going on from the chase and the attack. But for a dominant animal, in this case, as it's referred to as the alpha female, to direct wolves to specifically do an action, there's no evidence that suggests wolves can do that. Wolves cooperate in that social unit. To one of the reasons that they live in a social unit is to provide that ability to take down large prey. The more members of your pack, the greater chance you have of taking down a large animal like a moose. But there's no evidence in any research that suggests that one animal in the pack can direct the other wolves to do their bidding.
An assertion here by the character Luke that, I'll just read it. Of all the injuries I had in those years, not a single one became infected. If I'd been able to bottle the medicinal properties of wolf saliva, I'd be a rich man.
That's a little disturbing. You know, it would be like letting your pet dog lick an open wound and expecting it to heal completely and without infection. We know with the medical research that has gone on over the last several hundred years that the mouths of any mammal contain bacteria and little nasties that can certainly cause an infection.
I also appreciate this this dynamic with the alpha male and female. As it's portrayed in the book, if either one of those pair are killed or run off or whatever, the pack then suddenly becomes without its brain. That's how she's putting it. Basically, the pack would not survive. Can you speak to what really happens and how ridiculous
Sure.
that idea is?
Yeah, you know, most packs are family groups. And when the dominant pair, which are usually the parents of the rest of the wolves in the pack, when one or more of them dies or disperses, which is when they leave the pack, sometimes they do fall apart. Sometimes they disintegrate, and that's going to vary from pack to pack. Each pack has unique dynamics unto themselves. And so if you have a very new pack and these two adult animals just had pups and the pups are 2 weeks old and one of the parents dies, then yeah, sure, maybe those pups will die and not be able to function because there's not enough food, there's, you know, danger of injury, and the one adult just cannot handle that. For a pack that maybe has adolescent wolves or recently sexually mature wolves, it won't necessarily fall apart. Those adult wolves might choose to leave, which is very normal wolf behavior. They reach maturity and then they disperse and go out to find a mate and start their own family. And that might be interpreted by somebody like the author as meaning it falls apart. Or the pack might stay together and another unrelated wolf might come into the picture and take a position in that pack. It's hard to say, but there's not one standard answer. It does not always happen like that.
Well, and she has it as being that the remaining pack would then go outside that pack dynamic or that family and call out to try and get another wolf from a lone wolf or from another pack, almost like, you know, hiring from without rather than from within.
Mm-hmm.
It seems very far-fetched that a pack would actually advocate for that.
You know, and this is where wolf behavior gets really complex, and it's hard to give one answer to a question like that, because wolf packs are so dynamic that they're constantly in motion. And so in a typical pack, like a family group, where you have the parents and the offspring, it's not real likely that one of the offspring is going to rise to the level of a dominant animal and then mate with their parent. Most wolf packs tend to avoid that interbreeding naturally. In some closed systems like Isle Royal, you might see, you know, wolves that are related breeding with each other. But in most North American populations, the offspring tend to avoid reproducing with their own parents. And so there might be a situation where the wolves will howl and communicate. Some of the theories about why wolves howl include socializing with each other or sending out messages to other wolf packs. But we don't know. We don't know what they're saying. We don't know, you know, how to interpret those messages, because we can't ask the wolves what they're saying. So that statement in the book is more of a interpretation by this one person, rather than looking at all of the theories and taking a more scientific approach to it, that there could be a lot of reasons why they howl, not just that one reason.
But it really fits the anthropomorphic idea that they're acting just like we would.
Yes. Yeah. Looking for a new CEO. Let's send out the messages and get the perspective. Yep.
Well, let's upgrade if we can.
Right.
Let's get someone with more skills, right? Yeah, I think it's really interesting how the author assigns, you know, these different levels of skill and knowledge, that somehow an alpha or a dominant male or female has more knowledge and we can't afford to lose that knowledge. How ridiculous is that?
Well, it comes down to basic biology for the wolf. Wolves are born equipped with instinctual behaviors, and those instincts allow the wolf to be able to survive in their wild environment. And so their ability to hunt, their ability to interact socially with other wolves, their ability to travel and find, you know, figure out where they're going, their territorial behavior, that's all instinctual behavior. So those tools they have to survive. There isn't one wolf that might, you know, have a greater sense of smell by far than another member of the pack. Now, how good they are at stalking prey or leading their pack members might be an individual wolf trait, that it's a skill that they've developed through observation or practice, very similar to how humans develop skills. But to say that specific members of the group only have specific skills or talents is inaccurate.
Finally, this excerpt from the book: "My father taught me wolves can read emotion and illness the way humans read headlines."
You know, it's one of those, I don't know if urban legend is a good use of what I'm trying to explain, but there's this idea that, you know, canines, your dog, can tell when you're angry. They can tell when you're sad. Well, they might be able to tell that something's going on, but the way that they do that is by reading subtle cues we give off. Wolves and other wildlife use an extensive vocabulary of body language that we as humans forget that we do too, and we forget that when we're feeling a certain way, we are going to express that physically by the way that we move, the tone of our voice, the way we look at something or someone, how we carry our body. That's what wolves are looking at when they're picking up on those emotional cues. It's that body language. They cannot read into our emotional well-being and decipher, you know, that we're sad or that we're angry. Or that we're sick. You know, with the exception of maybe you have a huge infection and it reeks, you know, and they can smell it. If you're feeling sick or sad or down, you're going to portray that through body language. And that's what those animals are picking up on.
Well, if you've got gangrene, all you need is more wolf spit.
Right? There you go. And, you know, a generalization about wolves being able to read emotions of humans, just like humans read headlines, that statement could be viewed as accurate if we remember that the reason they can do that is because they are very in tune to those visual cues, where we as humans aren't as in tune and we forget that we could probably pick those things up just as well, but we forget how.
Yeah, so it's the implied translation of, yes, of reading those cues, which makes it ridiculous.
Right.
If we had to sum this up, if we had to sum this book up in terms of its ability to even remotely portray wolf behavior accurately, how would you summarize this?
I would say that this book, although entertaining, has no real wolf behavior information in it. There's a few generalizations. There's a few assumptions made on some limited wolf information. But as far as somebody that would want to read this book to find out more about wolves, they would do much better going to a wolf organization like the International Wolf Center or the Red Wolf Coalition or the Wolf Conservation Center rather than trying to glean some tidbits from this book.
Fantastic. Thank you for your time, Jess. I've been speaking with Jess Edberg, Information Services Director at the International Wolf Center. I'm Tom Eirich.